para mi vida.
Well, it's a pleasure being here at home again and to have a chance to come here and get a glimpse of what is happening at the Perimeter Institute. The field of neutrino physics has really been through a revolution in recent years of the discovery of neutrino mass and mixing oscillation. So I'm going to try to walk you through a little bit of those discoveries and what some of the implications and the open questions are. This is a rough outline of the kind of things that I want to cover. I won't follow a particular order. I'll try to jump around a little bit where I see the connections. But I wanted to remind you just quickly on how neutrinos fit into the standard model and then walk through this discovery of neutrino oscillations and why they present the need for a new paradigm of a change in the standard model as we know it. And that forces a set of very new questions that we can ask about the universe in particular and how the neutrinos interact with it. And there are some very interesting connections that I'd like to just point to in terms of our attempts to look at ramification connections to the evolution of the universe and cosmology, and a couple of examples on how making strides in this field will really require new efforts, new frontiers in technology, experimental technology, deep underground. And I'll finish with a summary. So light for the neutrino sort of starts here with its inventor, Wolfgang Pauli, back in the early 1930s, who invented the neutrino basically to, in a desperate way, to say energy conservation in the process of nuclear beta decay. It's now well known that both the electron and the neutrino share a continuum of energy in the decay of a nucleus under the weak interaction. And it was really Fermi who developed the fundamental understanding of these processes, and he devised a model which was very akin to quantum electrodynamics. But he was also able to explain how processes such as electron capture and nuclei occurred, and also the inverse beta decay reaction. Of course, in those early days, he wouldn't have appreciated the fact that describing things in the so-called four-point interaction would run into trouble at larger energies, and of course, we know now that this problem is resolved in the standard model, which is a renormalizable theory where these interactions are actually mediated by the weak effect bosons. But this particular interaction was the key to the possibility of actually trying to detect a neutrino, which didn't occur until about 25 years later in this famous experiment by Fred Linus and Cloud Cowan in the late 1950s. Which used this inverse beta decay reaction, and in this very rare process of trying to detect neutrinos from a nuclear reactor, made use of the coincidence between the ejected positron and the succeeding capture of the neutron in this process. That led then to the very fantastic work in the early 1960s at CERN, after the development of intense muon neutrino beams off the pion decay, a fixed target. And what was shown in this experiment is that a new flavor of neutrino was created called the muon neutrino, which we now associate with as charged partner, the heavy form of the electron, the muon. And not only did they show that neutrinos and antineutrinos produce particles that are different from one another, they also showed and demonstrated that these so-called muon neutrinos never produce an electron in quantum state. In other words, the neutrinos carry flavor, just like the weak flavor, just like the charged electrons did. Later on at CERN, with the creation of LEP, high precision measurements at the Z pole, we now know that there's only three active neutrinos, at least only three active flavors of neutrinos that are small in mass relative to the half the width of the Z boson at about 100 GeV. Well, this all fits nicely together in the so-called standard model, which has sp2 doublets of forks and leptons participating in the weak interaction, where every lepton there's an antilepton and so forth. However, we know that this model cannot produce masses for neutrinos. And I dug this little slide out just because I was near Ralph. I think this is the handwritten slide that I used in my master's thesis defense in 1988. But basically, to create a standard Dirac master for any of the quarks or leptons in a field theory, you need both right and left-handed states that produce this Lorentz invariant mass term in the Lagrangian. And in the absence of these right-handed states in the standard model, there's just no way of producing that mass term. So the crux of the matter is that this situation needs to now change because we now know that the neutrinos do have mass. And one of the puzzles is not only explaining that pattern of masses, as is still a fundamental issue for all of the other fundamental particles, but it's also an interesting question to ask why the neutrinos themselves are so much lighter than all of the other particles that we know about. So that brings us now to the discovery of neutrino oscillations and the discovery of mass in the neutrino sector. And one of the earliest hints came from actually studying neutrinos from the sun. We know that the sun is fueled by the nuclear furnace. It's effectively the fusion of protons into helium. But there's a rather complex spectrum of these neutrinos and these different parts of the nuclear fusion reactions that have been worked out over the past several decades and defined by people like John Pauls. One of the early pioneers of the solar neutrino field was Ray Davis, who in the early part of the 60s was working diligently both with John McCall and Bruno Pontecorvo to try to think of a way of being able to detect neutrinos from the sun with a simple quest in mind to try to understand whether this concept of the energy mechanism in the sun due to nuclear fusion was really correct. So he had an idea, put a very large tank of chlorine deep underground in a home state gold mine in South Dakota. It was an idea that was first suggested, this interaction was first suggested by Bruno Pontecorvo. And just to give you an idea of sort of pioneering efforts that were made at that time, you just simply need to do a very simple back of the envelope calculation. In the simplest sense, the sun is burning four protons into helium four with the emission of energy and neutrinos. And because you know how much energy the sun produces by observing the solar low luminosity of the over and far away, this simple calculation tells you that every second there's about 65 billion neutrinos coming from the sun passing through your thumbnail. So that seems like a lot of neutrinos. Unfortunately, the cross-section of the neutrino making any interaction with ordinary matter is so tiny that when you calculate, given the fact and also take into account that the threshold is just above the beryllium 7 line in the chlorine target, that the probability is only about 10 to the minus 30 that you would capture a single one of these neutrinos on a single atom in one day. So that immediately tells you that you have to have a lot of target atoms. In other words, you need a very large detector. And given the rare event rate, you need to take this detector very deep underground to mitigate noise from the cosmic ray muon flux in its projects. So Ray did this experiment. He did it over a very long period of time, about 35 years. This is, again, an old slide. But what he actually found was that the neutrino production rate was about three times short of what was being predicted at the time in these so-called standard solar model calculations for these ducts. I won't go into detail of any of the experiments that we're telling you about today, but I would like to leave you with one remarkable fact, that here you are basically pulling out every 2 days a single atom out of something like 600 tons of dry cleaning fluid, which is a target of 10 to the 30 pounds. So this is the sort of ingenuity that goes into these kinds of experiments. Well, that led to some excitement. In fact, Bruno Pontecorvo received a letter from John McCall shortly after Ray released these first results and explained his excitement in this simple letter. He said, "Dear Professor McCall, thanks very much for your letter in the abstract of the new investigation by Davis, the numerical results of which I did not know." He was still in Russia at the time. He says, "It starts to look really interesting. It would be nice if all of this will end with something unexpected from the point of view of particle physics. Unfortunately, it will be easy, not easy to demonstrate this, even if nature works that way." Bruno Pontecorvo is a man of great intellect and great foresight, and what I'd like to show you is the prevailing story which made him write on both fronts. So, of course, people were a little bit skeptical about this. I mean, in fact, factor three, complicated sun, very difficult experiments. Why not declare victory and go home? We got it all right within factor three. So, however, people were not necessarily ready to give up some new piece of physics, but certainly were enthusiastic about continuing the experimental program. The next experiment that came along was the so-called Kamiokande detector. It's a large water Cherenkov detector, which was actually first created to search for proton decay, which it didn't see. However, it made an extremely important contribution to this so-called solar neutrino problem, because it was the first experiment, in this case, detecting the higher energy mRNA neutrinos coming from the sun, that could actually point back to the sun and show that the neutrinos have originated there. And the way that's done is it uses the elastic scattering of neutrinos off of electrons in very clean water, and that interaction is very forward peak. So if you look at the azimuthal distribution here, you see this very strong forward peak on top of the radioactive background, which is the solar neutrino flux. But they also found that the flux that we were measuring was about half of what would be predicted in the standard solar model. Meanwhile, a very interesting situation was occurring. These large Cherenkov detectors, actually starting with the predecessor of the Kamiokande detector, not the IND detector in the United States, were looking at both muon and electron neutrinos produced in the atmosphere. So very simply, protons interacting with the upper atmosphere create showers of particles. The most important for neutrino physics, pions, will subsequently decay to muons and muon neutrinos. These muons subsequently decay to electron type of muon neutrinos. So naively, you should expect that there would be about two times as many muon neutrinos as electron neutrinos. Now, it's very hard to calculate with any accuracy the absolute fluxes of neutrinos coming from the atmosphere. But what you can predict very accurately is the ratio of the number of muon-type neutrinos to electron neutrinos that one would expect. But several experiments have been seeing too few of these muon neutrinos. Okay?
So these are electron neutrinos and muon antineutrinos?
These are, no, they're both neutrinos. So that was quite an interesting problem to pursue. The only way to pursue it with any accuracy is to make an even bigger detector. And that detector was called Super Kamiokande, which was about 10 times bigger than the Kamiokande detector, about 50,000 ton volume. It again wanted to be bigger to look for this piece, which we still have the privilege of seeing. However, it made enormous strides in elucidating what's happening in these muon neutrinos. The event rate in this large detector is now so large that one can actually look for the energy dependence effects that one would predict in neutrino oscillations by looking at over a very wide range of L over B in the oscillation probability, because while neutrinos are coming in through the top of here near the detector, that's at a very short baseline, and one doesn't expect to see a conversion vacuum of these neutrinos between types. However, when the neutrinos are coming in from the bottom, they're actually traveling over a very long stage line, something like 12,000 kilometers. And what the Supercamio Tanda detector has discovered is nicely illustrated here. As you look from above, you don't see the deficit of these muon neutrinos. But when you look from below, you see this very big deficit of muon neutrinos. But the electron neutrino profile is essentially intact. And this is the evidence in Supercamio Tanda, the discovery, if you like, for muon to have neutrino oscillations in the atmosphere. Meanwhile, the solar neutrino saga was continuing. Supercamio Tanda, just like Fitzcamio Tanda predecessor, now measured this solar neutrino deficit of the boron 8 neutrino flux with unprecedented precision. In addition, two new experiments had come online using gallium as a solar neutrino target. It works essentially in the same way as the old Ray Davis experiment does, the radiochemical experiment. But here, with the target being gallium, which gives the energy threshold right down below, including the dominant PP solar neutrino flux, and they also found this dust. So the by the late 1980s, the solar neutrino problem, in the early 1990s, the solar neutrino problem had really come to the peak. Here we had many different experiments over the entire energy range of the solar neutrino spectrum, all witnessing this deficit. And the problem now was, how do we build an experiment that could actually prove that the solar neutrino deficit was actually due to some form of neutrino flavor transformation? And that's where the Snow experiment came in, which now does not use light water, but uses heavy water, which can measure independently only the electron neutrino flux coming from the sun, but independently the total flux coming from the sun. And what one finds is that the electron neutrinos born in the sun really are found to be in deficit, like the predecessor experiments, but that the total flux of neutrinos is intact in agreement with standard solar model calculations. That was done because of Snow's ability to measure these two very unique interactions on deuterium. The charge current interaction is only sensitive to electron neutrinos. The neutral current interaction sensitive with equal probability to all active neutrino types. And so this is a detector that we continue to operate 6,800 feet underground, north of the conservatory, in an active nickel mine. And our next week will tell you about all of the glorious accomplishments of Snow, so I won't do that for him. But let me stick a number in your head, just because I would like to use it later. To achieve an experiment of this sensitivity, not only has to be extremely deep, but not only the water, and water, and all of the destruction of fields have to be of unprecedented cleanliness in terms of natural uranium and thorium. And to put that into perspective, the standard solar model predicts that you would get about 14 of these liberated neutrons from this neutral current detector per day. So to be able to make a sensitive measurement of neutrino transformation, you have to have a background of less than a neutron a day in 1,000 kilotons of heavy water. And that's really what was achieved in the Snow experiment. We see, and I like to now convert it to this unit, which I'll use again later. You're really talking about a background rate which is less than an event per ton per year. Okay, that's all very nice, and this is what I like to refer to as the flavor plot. This is one of the earlier flavor plots we published from the Snow data, but it basically shows you on the left-hand side is the mu-tau component of the solar neutrino flux, and on the horizontal axis, the electron component. And so the charge current reaction is measuring this electron component for you. The neutral current interaction is measuring the linear sum, and where they intersect is the answer. And you find that you're about 70 standard deviations off the zero axis. In other words, 2/3 of the electron neutrinos born in the sun have disappeared, and they've been converted to muon and tau neutrinos. What's more, the total flux of neutrinos is actually very nicely consistent with standard solar model calculations. Now, given that you know that neutrinos are transforming from one type to the other as they leave the sun and before they're detected on Earth, you don't actually know in the small experiment what the mechanism for that neutrino transformation is. You can hypothesize that the neutrino oscillation and the model fits very well, but as you know, theorists have very good imaginations and can think of other ideas and have explained that. And we know now that the dominant effect has to be neutrino oscillation, and that comes from information from this experiment called TAMLAN, which is a reactor neutrino experiment looking for the disappearance of electron antineutrinos coming from nuclear reactors. And for many decades, people have been trying to do this kind of search over baselines just short of about 10 kilometers and have never had the fortune of actually seeing an oscillation. It just so happens that in Japan, there's a whole series of nuclear reactors near to the old Kamio Konda site where the new Tamland detector sits now. And the average baseline is about 180 to 200 kilometers, and it's just perfect to test the so-called large mixing angle neutrino oscillation solution to the solar neutrino problem. And just a little over, almost a couple of years ago, this first result was published, showing that they had seen the disappearance of electron neutrinos very consistent with the results from solar neutrino oscillation. So that brings us to the phenomenology of neutrinos. And all of this mass and mixing can be accommodated in a standard picture called the unitary mixing matrix, which is just akin to the CKM matrix in the fourth sector, where you have a set of three parameters describing this mixing. The so-called theta 1-2 parameters is constrained now by this information from the solar neutrino data and a Tamland experiment. And what's more, these transitions are meant to be enhanced in matter. Because of this so-called Mateo-Chernov-Wolfenstein effect, as the neutrinos propagate through the dense matter of the sun, a resonant effect occurs and they feel a potential, which gives rise to the so-called matter enhancement, which modifies the mixing matrix in vacuum. So what happens at large energies, so up in the sort of boron 8 energies, you find that the energies are high and you're dominated by this matter potential. But as you go to low energy, the effect of oscillation is governed by the same oscillation that would occur in vacuum. And then between, at the level of an MeV or so, is the so-called transition area, which is creating some interest now, and I'm coming back to that. So the mixing in the 2-3 sector is now constrained by the atmospheric neutrino data. This is predominantly muon to tau neutrino oscillations. But here, we don't actually know whether the tan of the mixing angle is smaller or larger than 1. That's akin to saying that you don't know what the sine is between m squared 3 minus m2 squared. Okay? And we refer to that as saying something like we don't know what the error of the different neutrino masses are. In the simplest sense, you would just have in a regular mass error p, so the colors here are representing how much nu e in yellow is in nu 1, how much nu mu is in nu 1, and how much in each tau is a muon, and vice versa. Okay? And this mass scale is telling you something about the relative splittings of these masses. But because we don't know this mass split, we don't actually know whether we should create the hierarchy of these masses this way or in this way. We know the hierarchy in the solar case because we know that the mixing angle is less than maximum. So that's one of the new quests that we have in neutrino physics. What is this hierarchy? And what's more, we don't actually know what the absolute mass scale is. The third set of parameters has not been observed. We only have limits. These are experiments that require searches at, say, nuclear reactors or long base accelerator experiments on the scale of about 1,000 kilometers. And we only have limits on this mixing angle. And unlike these other two mixing angles, which appear to be large, it is obviously going to be quite small. Okay. This is particularly interesting because if there's non-trivial mixing with three generations of neutrinos, that is the state of 1-3 is non-zero, then there's a potential for a CP-violating phase in the neutrino sector, just like there is in the quark sector. So the values of knowing the values of these is of great interest, because it can lead to the possibility of CP-violation of the neutrino sector. And this is creating a lot of excitement lately, because people have now realized that if that CP violation is large enough, then it could actually be a new way of describing, explaining matter-antimatter asymmetry in the universe through a process called optogenesis, as opposed to the conventional way of doing it through baryogenesis. Neutrinos can be slightly different because they're intrinsically neutral particles. They can have additional CP phases if these particles are Majorana in type. And so one of the very fundamental questions we want to ask is whether or not neutrinos are their own antiparticle. And that leads me quickly to the concept of neutrinos double beta decay, which is a process that is actually allowed in standard models, although it's very rare because it's second order weak. But the process where a nucleus decays with a change in Z by 2, emitting two neutrinos and two electrons, is actually an allowed process that has been observed in nature. The one that interests us, and that type of process provides a continuum, just like in single beta decay where the two electrons share the energy amongst the two neutrinos. The process that interests us is this so-called neutrinoless double beta decay. And there, a neutrino, an antineutrino emitted at this vertex, needs to be absorbed at this vertex as a neutrino, in which case it has to have some sort of left-hand state to be observed here. So not only does the neutrino have to be identical to its antiparticle, but it needs to have some mass to have that velocity state component that it doesn't otherwise wouldn't have had leaving this vertex. And that's why we say that neutrinoless double beta decay requires a massive Majorana neutrino. And it's also a process that would violate lepton number by 2 units. So it's also simultaneously a test of lepton family symmetry in the neutrino cell. So these are extremely challenging experiments, but there's great excitement at the moment because there's actually an experimental goal post ahead for them. We know that the neutrinos have masses, and we know what their splittings are. Unfortunately, nature hasn't been quite as kind yet to tell us exactly how they merge as an effective mass in nuclear beta decay. But there are these so-called regions here. This inverted mass hierarchy is just the one I showed you earlier, and its neighboring normal mass hierarchy. There's nothing to say that the base absolute mass scale could be larger, and because of the small splittings, that the neutrinos are actually quite degenerate. So the state of the art in looking for this rare process has been the development of large and ultra-clean enriched germanium-76 crystals. And just to put things into perspective, this is where we are today, half-life limits of order of 10 to 25 years, the effective Majorana neutrino mass is in several hundred milli electron volt range. And it's also in here where some have claimed evidence for a signal in Heidelberg, Moscow. So next generation experiments that are under development right now want to make a leap of about a factor of 100 and come down here. To put that into perspective, these experiments typically are of the order of tens of kilograms of material. To do an experiment at this level of sensitivity, you require hundreds of kilograms to tons of material. And in the particular case of germanium-76, that's made more difficult by the fact that such an experiment is very expensive, on the order of $100 million. Ideally, if we really want to push down to the normal mass energy, we want to get down here, another two orders of magnitude. One certainly is not going to do that with this kind of technology. In fact, none of us really know how to get there. So developing the technology to make these leaps is certainly going to require this next generation of experiments. These experiments also have to be put very deep, and I like to try to demonstrate that here. So here again on this axis is the lifetime, so 10 to 25, 5 years up here, the effect of minor one neutrino mass. And this is events per kilogram per day, if you like. And at the moment, the existing experiments, there's just a horizontal bar here because of the fact that these experiments are limited by intrinsic radioactivity in the detection period. But what is being hoped for in the next generation is to reduce that radioactivity by some two orders of magnitude. But what I've shown here is, as a function of depth, the interaction rates in the detectors that occur just because of cosmic brain neutrons and their induced activities like transmutants. So it's clearly telling you that if you're going to have the sensitivity to do this kind of work, and have even after you reduce its radioactivity, you have to go very deep, 5,000 meters water equivalent or greater, which is sort of the snow lab that we're building at the moment. But just to put it into perspective, here again is that one event per ton per year at 1,000 meters. So the other interest with exploring whether or not neutrinos or majorana particles are gone is this very simple connection potentially to the so-called brain unified scale. We not only have to have a model which allows us to understand the mass scale of the neutrinos and the charged electrons and quarks, but we also need to understand why these neutrinos are so much lighter than their charged partners. And so if you allow both the raft and majorana neutrino masses for elementary particles, and you diagonalize that matrix, you arrive at this famous seesaw mechanism, where the neutrino mass is related to the raft mass through some large right-handed mass scale. Okay? And so what's interesting is those are typically of the order of 200 GeV. These are typically in the range of 10 to 100 millielectron volts. And if you just plug in some numbers, you get something that is relatively close to what one would expect for a brand new five scale. So that's quite interesting, because this neutrino mass matrix may be telling us something about randomification. So the dream is to come up with a theory which will not only explain all of the phenomenology of our so-called standard model, but one that will also unify the forces shown as the cartoon here in the three Trunnion coupling constants, where they would all come to a point sometime at high energy. And hopefully that sort of grand unifying theory would also be the key to trying to understand something deeper at the gravitational scale, the Planck scale, where we really quantize fully the four fundamental forces of nature. So when you do that with simple models, like an old SU5 kind of guts, it doesn't really work very well because it doesn't tend to converge from a couple of constants, but it also tends to underestimate the lifetime of the proton, which we haven't had this pronounced decay yet. Okay? So people play games with that, and maybe you would make larger group theories, or that supersymmetry and so forth, which tends to fix up this problem. These theories, of course, leading the theories of quantum gravity and so forth, have the interesting feature that they predict extra dimensions. There doesn't seem to be a way out of that. We live apparently in a 10 or 11 dimensional universe. signal. The question is, what does that mean, and can we actually create an experiment to this problem? So this is just actually a cartoon of the New York Times, so it's better than anything I could draw. So we apparently can think of ourselves living on this four-dimensional brain, and we're only connected to this higher-dimensional universe in very small but extra dimensions. The question is, how, if at all, can that communication take place? Is it taking place through the quantum of the gravitational field? Is it the dark matter of the universe? Maybe it's the neutrinos themselves. Don't come back to that. But we know, for example, that we live in a dark universe. It's been known for a long time that the rotational curves for standard galaxies cannot be explained just by the total amount of mass and light we see in the universe. So by creating this halo of dark matter, we can explain that. So the idea is that as we spin around in the galaxy, we're actually swimming through this halo of cosmological dark matter. And this kind of dark matter could be something like supersymmetric particles or something like this. But this whole situation with dark matter has really come to a head in recent years with exquisite data, not only from looking at galaxies and clusters of galaxies, by looking at distant redshifts of type 1 supernova, and this beautiful, fantastic mapping of the cosmic microwave background sky that has come from COBE and now superseded by this beautiful WMAP experiment. And what one finds is the matter density of the universe is about 25%, and now we live in this mysterious universe filled with dark energy, which is making up about 70% of our universe. What's more, we know that this dark matter is not barium. It's not the stuff that makes up you and me and the stars and planets that we see. We know from Big Bang nucleosynthesis and the measurements of the heavier elements, particularly deuterium and helium, that the baryon content of the universe only constitutes about 5% of the universe we live in. We also know now that it's not neutrinos. Because we now know that neutrinos have mass, despite the fact that we don't know the absolute neutrino mass scale, there's an upper bound on what the total amount of energy density the neutrinos can produce, simply because we have direct upper bound from trivial beta decay. But we also now, because of the atmospheric and solar neutrino data, we know that there's a lower bound. Okay? If you are willing to also use some less direct information from cosmology, it's likely that upper bound is more like here. So we know that at least the neutrinos contribute as much to the matter density in the universe as do all the stars and gas. But we also know that it's not enough to provide the so-called cold dark matter, to provide the dark matter that we see, and what is also required to explain the formation of large-scale structure in the universe. Okay? So that is my tie-in to supersymmetry and neutrinos in the grand unification scale, because maybe this cold dark matter really is in the form of something like a weak atom massive particle, and we should go out and look for it. That's hard. This is just a plot of the existing and projected hopes of direct searches for wimp dark matter. On the vertical axis is the spinning-dependent wimp nucleon cross-section. So up here is about where people live. In this area here, 10 to the minus 42 to 10 to the minus 43 square centimeters. That's the sort of sensitivity, not too surprising. It's a sort of neutrino-like cross-section. Plotted against the wimp mass. Okay? So the state of the art right now comes from the so-called cold dark matter search, which has put a limit of a few times 10 to the minus 43 square centimeters for something in 100 GeV mass. And these are some of our hopes. It's clear that to scale up and target mass and create detectors deep underground that are very free of background noise, we're really talking about trying to get down factors of 1,000 to reach deep into a sort of space that has some predictions for anomalous light sources. That again is not an easy pass. Here again is my experimentalist plot. Event rates in per kilogram per year. Here's the state of the art, where we where the experiment will run into a problem in about a year by operating at 2,000 meters water equivalent just because of fast neutrons produced by cosmic rays. You have to start going deep to get away from that background. Again, it's a challenge of reducing radioactivity and getting deep. Again, here's our little friend, the man who's done for you. So that's the sort of where it's going in that field.
Sorry, so, I didn't understand. What are these experiments looking for?
They're looking for a nuclear recoil of a wind particle with a nucleus in making up a detector material. It's basically an elastic experiment. They're extremely challenging because the energy spectrum is very low, typically tens of kilovolts. And you're talking about very large, low event rate, rare event searches with extremely low pressure. So they're extremely challenging experiments. See, I can't tell you everything because you wouldn't have an excuse to invite me back to tell you about it.
So where is standard interaction?
This is typical. This is sort of typical of a neutrino cross section for energy neutrinos. For MEV like neutrinos, right?
So if there is dark matter, it interacts more weakly than standard energy.
We know it can't be neutrinos because there's no mass.
Right. But if it was something with the huff and puff and the neutrinos that are
That's right.
How do you know the energy
situation? Well, they're cold. So they have a lot, so it's dictated, the recoil energy is dictated by the fact that the Earth is, we're going through the galaxy at 250 kilometers per second. It's just a gas. So I'm almost done, but I want to return back to solar neutrinos since that's sort of where started. So a great deal of progress has been made recently here at Corning neutrino energies, and the modern quest now is to really try to push down in energy. It's particularly interesting because despite the success of the standard solar model and the success of the experiments up here, this only constitutes 0.01% of the total solar neutrino flux. 98% of that flux occurs below 1 MeV. In fact, 92% of it occurs in this modern TP flux. So we'd really like to push down there, and the motivation for doing that is both astrophysics. We'd like to push on our basic understanding of stellar evolution, and one can do that by measuring more and more accurately and independently in real time these fluxes, and actually comparing the luminosity of the sun as we measure in photons versus neutrinos as a test to see whether or not there are other bizarre neutrino energy producing mechanisms in the sun. But of course, it's uniquely tied now to this understanding better fundamental neutrino properties. Precision measurement in these fluxes and the standard new picture of neutrino mass and solar physics is the only way to get precision in the solar mixing age. But it's also connected in the constraints that we presently have on the so-called 1-3 mixing angle But so far, we only have a limit, and it's important in pursuing things like CP violation and leptogenesis. But what excites me the most is it's actually clearly a probe of very exotic foods, sterile neutrinos, CPT violation, new interactions with mass variable neutrinos. Now, there are lots of people who can speak to that much and articulate that much better than me, but let me at least leave you with an interesting idea, which I would just put together generally as, you know, asking a simple question: does this whole new paradigm really hang all together, or are there surprises there? We've had nothing thus far except surprises in the diseases. And so one, just in the past 6 months or so, some very interesting ideas coming out where neutrinos can have new interactions with matter. And they actually can have very interesting connections to things like the dark energy problem. For example, in this particular model, these neutrinos can interact not only with the equivalent of scalar field, but their interaction with matter because of the dark field is also altered. And this is just an example of how the energy dependence across this energy spectrum is predicted to behave for this standard solar model solution, large mixed yang solution for the solar neutrino problem which we already discussed, and one with this matter mass, so-called mass variable neutrinos. So you can see by making precision measurements across this whole spectrum, you're really probing the neutrino matter interaction fundamentally, possibly looking for exotic physics. And what's interesting about this particular model is that this scalar field behaves in a similar way that from Hess's does, and can find the result of the dark energy problem. So maybe the neutrinos also have some connection with the strange new world that we live in with dark energy. Okay, I mean, and just one, a couple last things. I mean, you could ask maybe there's more to life than just these three active neutrinos. We know there can only be three active neutrinos because of these wonderful results from life. However, we have another result which is yet to be confirmed or denied in the liquid scintillator neutrino detector, which has evidence for muon to electron neutrino oscillations, but at a mass living scale, which is very different than these two scales. Well, you just can't do that for three neutrinos, because if you only have three neutrinos, you can only make two distinct masses. So if this experiment is really true, and it's now being thoroughly tested in a new experiment, Fermion, called Yin Boom, then you're going to start creating new states, which is new physics, that can also do it. Because it can't be active neutrinos, people have talked about these three sterile neutrinos, or even gone as far as destroying the cognitive CPT symmetry by creating these extra states by making the neutrino masses slightly different than the
anti-neutrino.
Well, it's a neutrino that doesn't have an interaction with matter that has the ordinary strength. So I hope that I've engaged you a little bit in the excitement of neutrino physics. It's certainly one that has grown exponentially in the past 2 decades. I've discussed, at least touched upon, much of the things in this list. I haven't had time to go into too much detail about a couple of very more, also very important things. Let me say very quickly that we know supernovas exist in the universe, and they create a lot of neutrinos. We had the great a possibility to observe some of them in 1987 with the Kamiokande and the IMD detectors, which generally speaking sort of confirmed our general concept of this of the evolution of neutrinos coming from the supernova. But I think you'd agree that the data is fairly scarce. It's hard to do a lot of serious dynamical testing of supernovae. In fact, theoretically today, it's actually very hard to theoretically make a supernova explode. People now think that shockwaves created by the neutrinos themselves and so forth are actually the reason. So having the possibility in these new generation detectors would also be essential for the neutrinos. And another probe of very high energy universe. Lots of excitement, lots of extremely violent, high energy cosmic rays coming from unknown sources deep in the universe. There's a point where, you know, if you're really going to look for new physics beyond the so-called GZK cutoff and so forth, it gets very difficult because there's a point about 10 to the 22 GeV or so where you no longer have a horizon to look at just in standard astronomy with light, because these photons don't get to you because they actually interact with cosmic rays, the cosmic microwave background, and don't get to us. So the only hope of really looking at the very, very high energy cosmic ray sky may be to actually do it in neutrino. That's a little bit more tidbits there. In the United States, we recently were called by the funding agencies to perform a study of the present status and the future direction of this field. That came together in the study, which is we call the neutrino matrix. Perhaps I'll give you a little bit of a taste of why I titled the seminar this way. It's actually a joint study between the Division of Nuclear Physics, Particle Physics, Astrophysics, and Particle Beams. And this is where I'll end with my summary. It's a very nicely written book, which is not just for experts, but also for funding people and so forth. But in it, we basically came up with 10 big questions for neutrino physics, which I'll leave you with. And I think that's as much as what I wanted to say.
Turns out the vacuum density is observation and minus the electron volts of the full power. So if there's a solar model, solution to the solar model, it's a real problem. And you, it gives you a mass difference of, as you said, square. The solution is it's minus the kilometers, approximately 10 to minus 3 electron volts. This may be a coincidence, or something.
Yeah, and this is exactly what I was referring to with this, these new interactions in mass-barrier neutrinos, and why I think we're excited. You can actually test those models by looking at the low-energy solar neutrinos and see if it changes the survival probability in this transition from matter to vacuum oscillation. But it's very interesting, like you said. What he's referring to is the fact that if you look at the mass energy density, the energy density coming from neutrinos, it's very similar to this dark energy density.
I'd like to ask a more technical question concerning this transition matrix U. So I understand you measure absolute values of probabilities, which give you those angles, theta 1, theta 1, 2, and so on. How come you can get those phases, as you call them, which determine...
That's a very good question. We don't, yes.
Yeah, but okay. So how you get some estimation concerning those
right.
phases?
So you have, I think you have to do two types of experiments to get the phases. There's two things that you have to know. It's coupled with the value of theta 1, 3, and delta. And so depending on the experiment that you do, it turns out that if you look for reactor neutrino disappearance, anti-neutrino disappearance, you can actually separate the theta 1-3 from the other mixing angles, but then your constraints are in delta theta 1-3 plane. Okay? So to have something orthogonal to that, you have to do an accelerator experiment. You have to do an accelerator experiment where you also look with high sensitivity for mu to e transitions, but which also has some dependence on theta 1-3, even though it's dominated by the 1-2-2-3 mixing. Okay? Now, to actually get the phase, though, you have to, well, that's enough actually to pin down the phase, except it's extremely difficult, because if the value of sine square theta 1/3 is much below the existing limit, it's extremely, extremely hard to see. Now, if you want to then go test CP violation, you have to do a whole new set of experiments. We have to say do a muon neutrino to electron neutrino oscillation experiment on the accelerator, but you also have to do the equivalent anti muon neutrino and anti electron neutrino oscillation experiment.
But in general, to get the accuracy of obtaining angles theta is much better than the accuracy of obtaining angles
theta. You need the equivalent of the Cronin and Fitch experiment in the neutrino side.
Whatever happened to the 17 KeV neutrino?
I killed it.
Personally?
Yeah. We can talk. It's a long story, the one outside was deeply rooted in my early days. It was resolved. It's largely experimental problem.
Yeah, I think last time was
If I understood this neutrino as double beta decay, could give a handle on the absolute gas of the neutrino if it's a higher atom.
Right.
Suppose it's a Dirac gas.
Then a neutrino as double beta decay
won't happen. But is there any other experiment?
Well,
you can think of
then it gets hard if the mass scale is small compared to a couple of hundred millielectron volts, then it's very difficult. The new predecessors to these fabulous tritium beta decay experiments that sort of pooped out at about 2 eV in their limits. There's an experiment called Catrin, which is being built in Germany, and German and US participators. It's actually an amazing collaboration. All of the people that built all of these tritium spectrometers over the last 20 years or have all got together to build it. They think they can get down into a direct mass limit for DV at a couple hundred millielectron volts. To go beyond that, and that kind of thing, all these problems. Now, that's an interesting scale because that's also now very nicely complementary with the limits that you get just from cosmology, which are at a few hundred millielectron volt scale from this Catrin experiment. But if it's very small compared to that kind of scale, like if it's 10 millielectron volts, I don't know how to do that.
Maybe you mentioned this, so what about carbon and maybe other experiments trying to verify the LSMG?
Well, there's been a long debate about that, and I think even the karma people, they can't rule out all the things. Okay. They rule out some of them. So this mini moon experiment, they promised me that they're going to tell us to be old in about 1 year.
But when did they promise?
It would be late 05, early 06. It's their goal, I'm doing.
Thanks.
Well, I was going to ask the last question, which I think was about that, which is I noticed that nobody said anything about CPC.
I think in the study that actually comes under number 6 because it has its own problem.
Things that otherwise wouldn't be mentioned.
No. I mean, I mentioned it in the context of LSMD, but you don't have to mention it in the context of LSMD. I mean, in fact, you can actually use the experimental data to test it. For example, you can use the CAMLAN data and compare it directly to the snow data and look for a difference in the mass splitting from the two experiments. It's the reactor experiment and the anti-neutrino source and the sun and the neutrino source. And so they are reasonably sensitive tests. The only difficulty with it, of course, is if you want to say how does that compare to, say, CPQ limits from K0 bar oscillation, making that connection a little bit model, but you can.
So
we're actually working on an analysis right now. I don't know when we finish the paper. It's actually a fairly straightforward. There are limits out there in the literature. We think we can probably do it out of factor 5.
Great. Do we have any other questions? Great, well, let's
thank you.
Thank you.